Christopher Cotter, and what you're about to listen to is one of five podcasts which the Religious Studies Project is presenting in association with the Non-Religion and Secularity Research Network. For those of you who don't know the Religious Studies Project, please take a moment to survey religiousstudiesproject.com, which features a few dozen of our weekly podcasts with leading international scholars on exciting developments in theory, method, and empirical study within the social scientific study of religion. In addition, there are roundtable discussions, book reviews, feature essays, opportunities digests, and more. For those of you who don't know the NSRN, it's an international and interdisciplinary network of researchers founded in 2008, which aims to centralize existing research on the topic of non-religion and secularity, and to facilitate discussion in this area. The NSRN run a series of events, including their biennial conference and annual lecture series, in addition to maintaining a vibrant website with extensive collections of resources, publications, and listings for teachers and students working in the area of non-religion and secularity. You can check out their website at www.nsrn.net. As the Religious Studies Project has a wider remit than this, we didn't want to fill all our listeners' inboxes with five quite lengthy podcasts, and therefore we've not made these available through iTunes. However, they are available on our website and are linked to from the NSRN's website. Due to the lecture style of these recordings, it's somewhat inevitable that the audio quality will be lower than we would like, and that there might be references to PowerPoint presentations or other events happening in the room. However, we know that these will be minor irritations when compared with the stimulating scholarship that you're about to hear, and we're very grateful to the NSRN for working with us to bring you these lectures. This podcast in particular is a lecture delivered by Grace Davey entitled Belief and Unbelief, Two Sides of a Coin. This was one of the keynote lectures at the NSRN's 2012 conference at Goldsmiths, University of London, in July. Grace Davey is Professor Emeritus at the University of Exeter, UK, and has held high-profile academic positions in Paris and Uppsala. She has published a number of key texts in the sociology of religion, including Religion in Britain Since 1945, Religion in Modern Europe, Europe, the Exceptional Case, and The Sociology of Religion. She is the co-author of Religious America, Secular Europe, and co-editor of Predicting Religion. More recently, she served as co-director on two European-wide collaborative projects on religion and welfare, entitled Welfare and Religion in a European Perspective, that was 2003 to 2006, and Welfare and Values in Europe, 2006 to 2009. Both are central to the understanding of modern Europe and develop, both empirically and theoretically, ideas about inclusion and exclusion, and have contributed to our recent two-volume co-edited collection, 2011, entitled Welfare and Religion in 21st Century Europe. The other four lectures which are available on the Religious Studies Project website are John Landman's NSRN annual lecture from April 2011, entitled Atheism Explained, the Evolutionary Origins of Atheistic Thought, and the other three lectures from the 2012 NSRN conference, Callum Brown on The People of No Religion, Humaira Iktidar on Secularization and Non-Religion in Non-Western Contexts, and Monica Volrabsar on Multiple Secularities Toward a Cultural Sociology of Secular Religious Distinctions. For now, I shall pass you over to Grace, who does a wonderful job of promoting her previous interview with the Religious Studies Project, or, as she refers to it, the Edinburgh podcast series, in her lecture. Thanks, Grace.
I'm delighted to be here, but also a little puzzled, because I don't naturally fit into non-religion and secular, so I had to think, now, how am I going to frame this? What am I going to say that contributes to this debate in a constructive way? And what I'm going to do is to, as it were, reverse what I normally do. This is what I normally do, and if some of you have heard this paper before, I apologise, but it is the best framing I can deal with for thinking about religion in Europe. If you haven't heard it and you want to, Chris has got it on a podcast, haven't you, more or less? Mm-hmm. Not quite like that, but more or less. in the Edinburgh podcast series, and I've also published on this. Because what I want to consider is how belief and unbelief are, if you like, two sides of a coin. And when I consider belief in Europe, and it has to have a focus, I don't think either belief or unbelief can simply free float, but that's because I'm trained in sociology, not in philosophy or theology. If I'm framing the way religion thinks, religion exists in Europe, I take into account cultural heritage. I look at the old model of the state church and consider it as a public utility. I look at the gradual inception of a market, or partial inception of a market in religion, which I call from obligation to consumption. I look at the new arrivals into Europe and the difference that has made to the religious map in this part of the world. I then look at secular alternatives, where I might guess catch up with your agenda a little bit. And then I consider the fact that Europe is not a global prototype. It's an exception in global terms. The relative secularity of Europe is not a model for export. So that's what I would do if I was talking about religious belief. Now, how do I reverse it to, as it were, bring some wisdom, optimistically, to understanding the secular? I'm going to say, is the secular culturally patterned? I'm going to do each one of these in a time, but these are the questions that came to my mind. What is the relationship of the dominant religion to... what is the relationship of the secular to dominant or particular forms of religion? Do you see the mirror image? Does the secular change over time? Yes, is what I would say. How is it carried? I'm interested in this because there's a lot of work in understanding religious worldviews on the institutional context and how they're passed on. And I think you should ask exactly the same questions about secular narratives. Does the secular respond to a market? And I'll show you what I mean by that. Is the secular influenced by external factors? Do new arrivals into, say, Britain or France make a difference to how the secular is understood? And then this is the key question, which we'll get to, and I'm still thinking about this. Who is reacting to whom? Where is the prior category? Where do we start the story? And I think you can cast that differently. Is the secular exportable? Or is it contextually determined, and therefore, in another context, it has to be worked out differently? So that's my agenda. I shall return to it at the end. We might have answered some of it, we might not. But I hope it will stimulate debate. That's the point. Now, this I regard as a fact, that the Judeo-Christian religion is a crucial factor in the making and remaking of modern Europe. Now, I'm not concerned about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. It is a fact. And I think we just begin there. This is over two millennia, and it has formed, for example, our use of time. In the West, we have a seven-day week, which is a Christian pattern. Many of our holidays are premised on Christian festival. Maybe they, in turn, were built onto pagan festival. Weeks, weekends, holidays, celebrations... it's deeply embedded in simply the way we organise ourselves. And whether you establish or unestablish a church, I think makes very little difference to that. That is there. But so too is the second thread, formative thread of Europe, which is Greek rationalism. And this feeds very directly into the European Enlightenment, which is basically a secular story. Now, whether you necessarily cast that as a rejection of religion or as a parallel narrative, I think makes quite a difference to how you're going to understand the relationships. And the third factor that you see in the making and remaking of Europe is Roman organisation. So Europe has a Christian narrative lying behind it, which is formative and influential, but it's not the only story. There is a secular story there right from the start, prior, in fact, to the Judeo-Christian narrative. But where I would start, the first statement I would make is that when I pick up the story of secular and non-religious, and we'll come to that in a minute, I hear not the rejection of belief, but the rejection of a specific form of belief. If you pick up Dawkins' book, it starts with, I think it's a caricature, I think most people think it's a caricature, of the Old Testament God. But it's not any old God. It starts with the assumption of some knowledge which is coming out of a tradition. And Sam Harris is writing a letter to a Christian nation. He's not writing a letter to a religious nation. So already you have got a kind of framing of the secular. Now, the first question I want to ask is, as Monica hinted at yesterday, Europe has, there is a oneness about Europe, though where it begins and ends is always disputable, particularly when you get to the east side of Europe. But Europe has within it different Christian narratives, which I'm going to show you just by means of pictures. And I'm going to ask whether you get a different secular in different parts of Europe. I'm going to give you three examples. Now, here are the three, four traditions. This is the Catholic one, okay? Who knows where that is? Tracy gave you a hint right now. Becky knows. Go on, Becky. At Uppsala. That's where I work a lot. Here's the Lutheran narrative, Nordic Europe, parts of Germany too. Quite a different theology, which has huge implications for understanding the secular. The notion of two kingdoms makes a big difference in the legitimacy of the secular. That's Sofia, okay, it's the Orthodox tradition. And here is Westminster Abbey, in case it escapes you. And we will talk about the Anglicans in the end. But the first three, and here I am linking very much to what Monica said, and I'm drawing on David Martin, because I want you to understand, you know, how the secular mirrors the dominant religious tradition. Now, the French case is the best known one. This is, historically, there's a hegemonic Catholic Church, very powerful historically, which proscribed any form of dissent. The Reformation could have taken off in France. There is a very important Calvinist current from the 16th century onwards in France. Calvin was a French speaker, but it's never allowed to develop. It is brutally suppressed, and many Huguenots fled to different parts of the world, including England. So effectively, you have no dissent within. But what happens eventually, from the Revolution onwards, and culminating in the establishment of the Third Republic in 1870, is an ideologically secular state which confronts the church. And so you have a confrontational model in which the state claims for itself. It really is like the Catholic Church without the Pope. And it has its ideologies and its sacred places and the doctrine of laïcité, which is differently constructed, but the absence of religion in the public sphere, which is philosophically strong. It is an ideology of philosophy which is completely absent in this country. And this has led to a certain understanding of the secular, a certain defense of the secular, in which the appearance of religion in the public square is very problematic, symbolized, of course, in the wearing of the veil. But it's a French story, just as much as it is a secular story. Now, take the Norwegian case. Is there anyone from Norway here? Well, I doubt that I'm telling you anything you don't know, but there are disproportionately large numbers of humanists in Norway. It has a very big, well-organized humanist association with a super website, all in English, very Nordic. And there's a very nice argument in this, which goes like this. We do not like the idea of a state church. Fair enough, that's perfectly logical. But while the state church has funding from church tax, we too will have funding from church tax. So what you're in fact doing is constructing a parallel to the state church, which is completely different from the French case. Now, the Norwegian state church is under review. It may turn out to be different in a generation. And the humanists are, I think, a bit over a barrel. Because if they argue too hard for separation of church and state and a different form of funding, they might find that they have cut off the branch on which they're sitting, which is not a wise thing to do, because their finance might go become a very different situation. And the other thing, of course, that Norwegians, humanists do and have developed and thought about very carefully is the fact that because so many Norwegian people, like Nordic people, still return to the church for the primary marking of birth, confirmation, marriage, and death, they have evolved a whole set of parallel rituals. They need to do that because the marking of ritual is important in Norwegian society. And so, you know, if people or families place themselves in the humanist strand, which is fine, their kids or their families are missing out on something that Norwegians do. So they need to consider alternatives, whereas in France and Britain too, very few children are baptized, and so you don't need an equivalent. You can have one, but it's not got the sort of contextual push that you'll find in the Nordic countries. And here's a very unscientific Greek anecdote. I had lunch in Greece. It was a business lunch, and there were four of us around the table. One was the director of a kind of private college, and he took very little part in the conversation, but he did pay for the lunch, so he was quite important. And then there was me, and then there was his PA, who was actually helping quite a lot because she was an English speaker, and the guy who was thinking about setting up a branch of this college somewhere else. So that was the context. It so happened that the PA was very Greek, but an unbeliever, but firmly Orthodox. The other was a younger man who was Greek and an evangelical. Not first generation, he'd come from an evangelical family. And the atheist Greek Orthodox would not have it that he was Greek. So, you know, the elision was between Orthodoxy and Greece, and the belief was irrelevant. And so you get another construction of how you can, as it were, exist in an Orthodox system as an unbeliever, but you are firmly Orthodox. What she rejected was not his belief, but his non-Orthodoxy. And I sort of thought about that. And she was very vehement. She's absolutely sure that he could not be Greek. He was as Greek as she was, in terms of parents. So think how the particular form of religious expression is colouring its absence or the reaction to it. Now, thinking more broadly, Europe's historic churches, they are there historically, are public utilities. I think this is the best way to understand them. They can no longer coerce European populations. We're very thankful for that. There's no place for that kind of dominant religion in a modern democracy. That's gone. They used to be excluding and exclusive. I don't think they can be, except in this rather subtle way that I've just explained to you in Greece. They're still there, and they are, as it were, there at the point of need for populations who live in a designated place, because they all work on a territorial model. Basically, they are parish churches. And again, you need to grasp, particularly Americans think very differently in, from this point of view, the parish is an absolutely key unit in European understanding. And of course, it's a unit in which the secular, the civic, and the religious overlay each other. And for centuries, European lives were, as it were, governed by the parish, whether in terms of poverty or in terms of registration or in terms of this or in terms of that, that's where you belonged. So it's a very powerful unit, even now, if it is, of course, overlaid by extreme mobility. And what I'm trying to do is, in my own work, is to understand how this works in 21st century Europe. And I had two cracks of it. One was Believing Without Belonging, first put into print in 1990, and the one I now much prefer is Vicarious Religion. I'm not going to develop that because I shall run out of time, but if you want me to, I will afterwards. The best example of vicarious religion now, I think, is Jade Goody. Jade Goody, whose life was very far from conventional church-going, turns back to religion when she finds herself terminally ill. Now, why did she do it, and how was the, as it were, the meeting of this individual and the church? It's something that interests me, but maybe doesn't interest you. So we're not going to go there now, but we're going to think a minute about Believing Without Belonging. I'm still rather astonished by the way this sort of took off. But the only thing I really want to pick up is quite a number of scholars think that this is a step towards the secular. On the whole, I agree, because I don't think a religious tradition or any other tradition, which is what we're going to come to in due course, can be sustained without an institutional root. And if you believe without belonging, you lost that connection. The trouble is that even if you go that way in your logical thinking, this grey area of indifference or neither one thing nor the other doesn't disappear. I suspect the grey area is becoming more secular, but grey it remains. And so we still need to attack it in terms of intellectual activity and trying to understand what's going on. And my second go at it was vicarious religion. You see the definition. The point I want to make to you this morning, which is only part of the story, is that the public utility is inclusive. The only way you get out of it is by contracting out. And for those of you who are not English speakers, contracting out comes from trade union language. And it depends on whether you are a member of the union because you are a boilermaker or a train driver. If you don't do anything, you simply are a member of the union by virtue of your job, unless you contract out. And then there was a very important moment in trade union history where you were only a member of the union if you contract in. So it's the default position. And I think the default position of the parish, the territorial model, the public utility, legacy of the church, state church, is you're in unless you contract out. Now, you're perfectly free to contract out, but one of the things you can do in European history is to look at different European societies and see when that moment arose. When was it possible for you to contract out without penalty? Surprisingly late in many European societies. But I don't think there's any European society now where you can't contract out of the state church with no penalty whatsoever. That's a good thing. That's how democracy should work. But it does mean that inside these state churches, inside this model, were enormous range of shades of belief. Don't think everybody went there was a paid-up believer or even had really much grasp of what Orthodox Christianity was. Now, if you go week by week to church, a sort of drip feeding will occur and you will know more than if you don't go to church. That's why believing without belonging means you drift. But there is no clear line between the religious and the secular. And there are many unbelievers who access their state churches. I mean, you've only got to hang out in a parish to meet them. It is an inclusive model. If you really don't like it, you've got to step away from it. But Europe's changing. That is the public utility, and we are gradually shifting towards a model of choice, which I welcome. I think this is how it should be. Of course, no adults. Children is a more tricky question, because I think parents will nurture their children in whatever they think is important, and I think to pretend otherwise is not helpful. No adult should be coerced to go to church. That is unacceptable and should not happen in a modern democracy. But a certain number of people do choose, and they choose variously. Now, this is not a market like there is in America, because it overlays the public utility. And what we have in Europe is effectively a double economy. It is more of a market in England than it is, say, in Sweden. It's more of a market in England than it is in Greece. But they're all moving towards more choice. Is this good news or bad? Well, it's good news. But there are some casualties. And this is just a personal kind of predilection, excuse it. I think one of the big casualties is music. Because how many children learn music, basic music, in church choirs? Now, there's no reason why music should be learnt in church. It can be learnt anywhere. But musical literacy is not as good as it used to be. And I'm sad about that. I'm also sad, in fact, that the other casualty, of course, is religious knowledge, religious literacy. And I think the lack of religious literacy is a very serious thing in modern society, which will develop. Adam knows all about that. Because nobody is helping themselves by not being able to talk about an important issue. But what I want you to think about more than anything else is to appreciate that the secular now changes in nature, I think, because it becomes one choice among many. As everybody chooses, if you want to, you can choose a secular option. Everybody is making choices. Nobody is assuming anything. Contracting in replaces contracting out. You are not a member of a religious group until you decide you will be. Now, as I hope I made clear, we are in a transitional or halfy-halfy situation which probably will endure for some time. So this is not clean at all, but then human living is messy. And I'm always suspicious of any kind of sociological analysis which assumes that human nature or human society is clean and tidy. I mean, it may be wonderfully satisfying sociologically, but it simply doesn't resonate with reality, because reality is not like that. But I think a fundamental shift takes place when the whole thing works on choice and contracting in, rather than the default, the assumption that you are in unless you contract out. And here we are in different European societies at different stages along that line. And I think you could do this analysis for each individual society, and you'd find a slightly different combination. Now, if you have a market, you have gainers and losers. And I know who gains in the religious market. The gain in the religious market, the popular religious choices, no prizes really for getting this, are the charismatic evangelical churches. We know that. Less widely known, though it's now coming into the literature more and more, is the cathedral or city centre church. cathedrals are growing in popularity, whether you think of regular or irregular worshippers, pilgrims or tourists. All those categories are growing, and of course they're very porous categories. Why are those two very different things growing? Well, my hunch is because they're both experiential. And paradoxically, what is not growing is what in the 1960s and 70s social scientists thought was the future, which is the liberal, engaged Protestants in tune with the world, or if you like, modern Catholicism post-Vatican II, which was like the world and so easily accessed, etc., etc. Well, it seems that most Europeans don't want to do on Sundays what they do from Mondays to Saturdays, and they seek something a little bit different. Now, this was counterintuitive for social science, but I think Durkheim was right. It is the experiential element that appeals, and the purely cerebral doesn't do so well. But this led me to another question. Who are the gainers and losers in the secular market? Now, you're going to answer that in a minute and tell me, okay? And it led me to another question. Is there an experiential secular? I don't know if Stephen's here. Maybe he hasn't made it or can't come this morning. When we were in Turku at a conference describing this, a lot of secular people around the table, and they all said to me, "Ah, yes, now the secular includes peak experience. It's got conversion experience or deconversion, whatever you want to call it. Secular people, just like religious people, have moments of, if I may say so, transcendence or joy in their children, something that as it takes you out of the ordinary." That's fine, right? That's fine. But that's not quite what I mean. Because the experiential element in worship is collective and happens when you're worshipping. Now, if by definition you don't worship, I can't find it. But maybe you can. Maybe it's on the web. Maybe it's on... I want to know. But in that, the secular very often has a rational root. I've thought this through, and I don't think I believe in this or that. Is that necessarily a contradiction to the experiential? Is an experiential secular an oxymoron? Now, I don't know, but I really would be intrigued by your answers. My next factor is new arrivals. You can't analyse religion or the secular in Europe without looking at what is happening in the post-war period, which is, for economic reasons, we needn't really do this in detail, waves of immigration when new labour arrive, and new forms, we're looking for new sources of labour, and then in the 1990s we're looking for people to work to support all those like me on pensions, because of, you know, the imbalance in the demography of Europe. Of course, this peaked in 2008, and then everybody, the collapse in the economy meant that there was hostility towards immigration rather than welcome. But this is an economic story with economic motivation, variously in the post-war decades. It's not a story about religion, but it has huge implications for religion. I make the same plea everywhere I do this, is how important accurate facts and figures are, how distorted popular and media conceptions are, and how dangerous they are. And anybody who teaches should be, as it were, working on this in schools or wherever. You should be underpinning this with good information about the size of this population, and as it were, countering media stereotype. But who arrives, amongst other things, new forms of religiousness? So the market is different. Which ones? Well, just for completeness, I mean, obviously there's huge influx, Christian influx, which is altering the nature of Christianity. Now, I'm not sure that this makes all that much difference to the secular, except to say that Christianity has, in some senses, become more visible and more conservative because of the nature of the immigration. It's a commonplace now to say that there are more black people worshipping on Sundays in London than white people, and it's also driven up the statistics in London. How far London is a particular case, we all wait to see. The kind of thing Becky's worked on, reverse mission, and we all know the very unpleasantly racist story of rejection in the 50s and 60s, which brings no credit on anyone involved in it. I'm going to return to the Muslim case in a minute because I think it is probably crucial. But when I was thinking through this as a kind of wider story, I think Buddhism is very interesting because there is a growth in Buddhism, but interestingly, it is Buddhism attracts very significant numbers of Western adherents. If my students who are going to do some kind of observation of a religious group want to find Buddhists, they find any number of Buddhist groups in Exeter, but they are all white people. I don't think anybody has yet ended up, well, Exeter is not a terribly diverse place, so it might be asking too much, but they find Korean churches, they find Chinese churches, but they haven't yet found, as it were, immigrant groups of worshipping or Buddhists who are gathering together. And I think there is quite, sorry that slid off the bottom, but if you actually look at people who oppose or support establishment of the state church, the Church of England, you will find Buddhists almost always align with the secular, whereas most minority faiths align with the national church or the state church. And I find that interesting. I'm not going to draw too many conclusions for it, but I think they do it probably for socioeconomic reasons. That they have, you know, they're very firmly established in British society, and they don't feel vulnerability, which I know minority faiths do. And some spokespeople for minority faiths certainly think that the established church is less hostile to them than, say, the French secular state. So there's quite an interesting thing going on there, but you might want to disagree with that. Now, Islam is hugely significant. Not because it's particularly numerous, it isn't. It's growing, but it's not huge. But because Islam does something to European thinking which disturbs Europeans, because it does not fit the traditional European solution to the problem, which is that religion is a private matter. From the time of the Peace of Westphalia, you get this notion that the way we deal with religion in Europe is to say it's a private issue, keep it out of public life, and all will be well. Now, Islam is not easy to privatise. Now, there's a lot of debate in Islam about whether there is going to be a European form of Islam or a European way of being fully Muslim but also European that could incorporate European ways of doing things, but it's not an easy story. And for this reason, you keep on getting these flashpoints. Now, the first one was the Rushdie controversy, and the which was coterminous with the veil, the big debate about the veil. They both start in 1990. They're both there for the same reason. Islam is claiming something which Europeans find difficult. Young Muslim women in France want to wear the veil, which is not really a problem in this country. Germany is a kind of variation on that theme. And in Britain, we have the big debate about freedom of speech, blasphemy, that kind of thing, which the French find mystifying. But basically, the same issue is arising. How do you accommodate within a modern democracy a group of believers whose claims encroach on the public sphere? when Europeans feel that this is not the best way to manage religion. And you have the Dutch debate, which has the tragedy of the murder of Theo van Gogh. And Dutch liberal values are defended by Dutch people, very understandably. But can you defend liberal values by exclusion? Or are you undermining your position? We have Danish cartoons, we have Swiss minarets, we have huge debates about Sharia law, and the Swedish doctoral thesis is a legal question. Why is it in Europe that we embrace cultural pluralism, we love our Indonesian restaurants, we dress, we enjoy music, but legal pluralism, all the hackles rise? History of legal pluralism is of course rather different because it was part of the colonial story. As we claimed parts of the developing world, Africa, we permitted Africans to keep parts of their own indigenous legal process within our imposed legal system. That's great. But when it comes back to us, it's very problematic. It is problematic. I fully agree that it's problematic. But don't think that there isn't a history to this story. All of us have to deal with this question. We all do it within our national parameters, so the French story is different from the English, from the Dutch, etc. Look at one English solution. The classic British compromise. Have your cake and eat it. All right? You could try and rephrase that to as a caption for the picture. Now, show this to my French colleagues, and it's just unimaginable. Go into land at Heathrow, go through immigration, what you see, use your eyes. Go into Charles de Gaulle, and what do you see in immigration? Something quite different. You'd never see a scarf, you'd never see a turban. It's impossible in the French situation. Which makes me thoughtful about this. I used to think, and I'll be quite honest, I used to think the British were better, but maybe I would. I quite like pragmatism. I'm not terribly good at philosophy. This is pragmatism versus principle. This is why it's different. British look for a solution to the problem. This is how we resolve our issues. We find a way out of our dilemma. The French are logical. And I used to think that the British pragmatism was sort of kinder than French logic. In fact, I now think that there are good and bad versions of each. I think there is a very healthy pragmatism which allows for exceptions. And I'm rather sad in British society that we're losing that capacity. But pragmatism, of course, is very exposed to power. Pragmatism can mean that the strongest and the loudest get their way. And that is dangerous. Now, in the French system, you go for the principle and you apply it. And there is a fairness about this, which I accept, but there's also a rigidity. And it's very hard on the French people who never get into the system, the sans-papiers, because they simply don't, they're not in the logic, they're outside it. And so you do get inclusions and exclusions in both systems, but they're different ones. And I think what we've got to do, rather than borrow somebody else's system, is make our own system as fair and, as it were, respectable and consistent as possible. Which is tricky, because the European Court of Human Rights, of course, is a player in this. And the European Court of Human Rights is not consistent in its judgments. It changes its mind, and it doesn't always find, you know, it's not always easy to see a string of judgments that go in one direction. But here we arrive at this difficult question of competing human rights. And I listened carefully to the debate yesterday. And I think here, the only conclusion I can make is that the grass on the other side of the fence is always greener. because all of us think that somebody else is getting a better deal. I hear humanist people feeling excluded. I hear Christian people feeling hard done by. And I think that when I look at the court decisions on human rights, mostly secular rights are trumping religious rights at the moment. But I'm very willing to hear your different, as it were, interpretations of that. What grieves me about the whole thing is that extremists on each side are, as it were, shouting at each other. And I worry about the much more confused situation in the middle, which I don't think gets a proper voice in legal argument, because legal argument is a rather different thing from the messy realities of everyday life. I am pretty clear that compromise or pragmatism becomes increasingly difficult. It doesn't fit easily in the law. And as I say, done well, I'm rather in favour of compromise and pragmatism. What is happening all over Europe is that more or less secularised populations, because the religion has come back in the public sphere, doesn't mean that we have become less secular. This is one of the paradoxes of European society, that secularisation develops, continues remorselessly, at the same time as religion returns to the public sphere. And these are not connected. This is a paradox. Which means, this is where I regret the loss of information and knowledge, we tend to have, and Adam raised this yesterday, a very ill-informed and ill-mannered conversation about religion, which is unhelpful to everybody. How can we do better? That's a real challenge. This is why religious education in schools is so important. This is why good university teaching is so important. That people simply know enough to discuss the issues they're dealing with. And then in the academy, new forms of theorising are slowly emerging in different areas of the social science in order to accommodate the religious factor. Instead of ignoring it, which is what social science has consistently done, it's back in public or academic discussion. And Habermas, I think, is a very good example. Habermas' new theorising on religion is controversial. Not everybody agrees with it or thinks it's done well. But I do admire a scholar in his 80s who, as it were, thinks afresh. There are many scholars in their 80s who can't be bothered. And so even if you might say the solution is not perfect, I admire him. And in fact, I've heard him speak once, and he is so clear when he speaks, you think, where did all that very difficult prose come from? But here is the big question. If we are going to reintroduce religion into the social scientific agenda, do we have to reintroduce the secular or the non-religious? And I was very interested in the arrival of this group and its importance and significance, because I don't understand why you've called yourself non-religion. I think you've painted yourselves into a corner, because you've got a double negative there. Well, that's what I feel, but I mean, you may not, that doesn't matter. And so I really thought hard, now where do we begin this story? Which is the prior category, the religious or the secular? Where does this start? Who is going to decide? Now, I think you can cast it in two completely different ways. You can begin where I began. The Judeo-Christian tradition is part of our European heritage. You can also say that there is no new known human society where there is no religion. Many individuals, but no society where there is no religion. And therefore, you react against that. But you could also argue equally well that the European Enlightenment, coming from Greek rationalism, feeding into European social science, is very, very secular. it is premised on a secular philosophy of religion. And it is taken aback when it has to understand religion reappearing in the European agenda. That's what Habermas is doing. So, as it were, where do you begin this story? Which one of us is discomforted? Is it, as it were, a primarily religious narrative against which people who prefer otherwise react? Or is it a very secular discourse of social science in which people who are interested in religion have to put themselves on the agenda? And if social science is to take notice of religion and do the job properly, it is going to change in nature. International relations, economics, philosophy are all going to change because their logics are secular. So we've all got work to do. What I think there is there's a very wide spectrum of belief. There's a very wide spectrum of unbelief, and the crossovers are murky, to say the least, and they need to be determined empirically rather than philosophically. And the importance of the middle ground and the avoidance of binaries. That's where I start. And cheerfully, as I always have done, I plunder other people's data. Now, where do these guys fit in? You talked a lot about them on Wednesday when I hadn't arrived. I'm sorry about that. This is how I think about New Atheism. You don't have to agree with me. I'm very struck by this list. And I put Polly Toynbee in every time because, if not, it looks totally gendered. Is there a reason for that? I ask that question. If you look at some patterns of belief, they're gendered. Patterns of unbelief are gendered. It's a very gendered story. Michel Onfray is the French version. It's reactive, I think. I'll explain that in a minute. Is it normal? Well, it's more normal in Europe than it is in America, though America's changing. Is it fundamentalist? Is it exclusivist? Is it unreasonable? Is it intolerant of what? Some key points. Now, this is what I think is crucial. This is not a zero-sum game. I think that New Atheism is reacting to the unexpected return of religion in the public sphere. The normal was the secular. The expectation was secular. Modernization brought secularization, and then suddenly it was disturbed. And the reaction was swift, and it was aggressive. That's how I understand it. But I'm very happy to be proved wrong or offered another point of view. I do see it as a secular fundamentalism, and that date is incorrect. It's in the 2000 book on sociology of religion that I consider the notion of secular fundamentalism. And in fact, the new edition of 2013, which has just gone to press, develops it a little bit further. And New Atheism is an idea that that is clearly resonant because these readership figures are huge. I'm sorry Stephen's not here because I know he's written about readership and reception, and I really do think we want more work on who these people are. That's a really interesting question. Who is reading this? And I've already said that it is a very gendered story, and I haven't heard any of that since lunchtime yesterday. Here are a couple more pictures. What's happened to these buses? I haven't seen one for ages. Are they still about?
No.
The
money ran out. Okay. Do you know the German version of the buses? I heard this from a German scholar. I hope I'm correct. They were not allowed in Berlin, which strikes me as very unusual because Berlin is a very secular city. So some humanists, I imagine, hired a bus and drove it round. And some Christians got a bus and said, drove behind and said, maybe there is. I just think that's rather nice. That's good demographic exchange. I'm nearly at the end. This is my last factor, if you went back to the original slide. Is Europe secular because it's modern? Or is Europe secular because it's European? This is a really one of the questions that really goes down to the heart of the matter. The question interrogates the relationship between religion and modernity. Is there any natural affinity between being modern and being secular? I think you have to understand Europe and Europe's secularity as part of Europeanness. I guess that partly was what Monica is doing in her project. The distinctiveness of the European case is what strikes me, as opposed to the American, and the distinctiveness of European secularity. And this is where we come back to our starting point. Is the secular culturally patterned? For a sociologist, most certainly yes. For a philosopher, maybe not. But social science is what I'm trained in. What is its relationship to dominant particular forms of religion? Close. But which one comes first, I think, is tricky. Does the secular change over time? I think so. And I think the crucial change is when it simply can become one choice among many. And I think that's a very healthy moment in European evolution. I'm puzzled about how the secular is carried as a worldview or philosophy of life. I mean, there are humanist groups, secular societies, and they clearly are key carriers. But I think there's another point I'm going to mention in a minute, it's on the next slide, but I think that's a very good research question, is how are these ideas carried and passed on? Is it generational? Is it family? Is it something different? Does the secular respond to a market? What forms of the secular flourish in the market? How do you market the secular? Whole new set of questions come up. It is influenced by external factors, I'm sure of that. It depends on who's coming and who's leaving. How you construct the secular depends on your environment. What are you, as it were, reacting to? And it's a very interesting debate in Europe, because both the secular narrative and the religious narrative are discomforted by Islam. But I say both the secular and the Christian narrative are discomforted by Islam, but in different ways. And they defend different things, as it were. Who is reacting to whom? That, I think, is the key question. Where is your story beginning? Is it beginning in, as it were, a tradition which secular people react to, or in social science, the secular is quite definitely the dominant narrative, without doubt. And it was a real struggle to get money and recognition for research on religion. Now, that changed dramatically. That's another story. But where did all this money come from? My hunch, it was the right thing done for the wrong reason. And the wrong reason was the fear of Islam. But it's better than the wrong thing done for the right reason, I think. Who is reacting to whom? Where does this story begin? And is the secular exportable? Is the European secular something that we offer the world? Or is this not a sensible thing to do? Just an American postscript. Why is the American story so different? Now, I know the American story is changing. Phil Zuckerman has pumped me with the statistics. Boy, does he do it. He's very effective. That, you know, the non-religious group is growing in America, and clearly there is the culture wars thing in America, that there is strong reaction to the religious right, but there's also a much, much broader spectrum of religion. So you can oppose the religious right by being moderately religious, by being in a different sort of religion, which is just, in fact, probably more attractive to many Americans than being non-religious. There is no dominant state church in America, so you're not going to get a mirror image effect. It's too complicated. And there's an entirely different political context. Note the absence of a secular left. No socialist parties in America. It's not part of American history for reasons that go way beyond what I've got to say this morning. And in Europe, but not in Britain, socialist parties are carriers of the secular. The French idea of a laïcité is carried initially in the French left. And there is, of course, a tension between the socialist left and the communist left in all over Europe, but they are both premised on the secular, interpreting it slightly differently. And they don't exist in America. It's a different story there. And here, I'll just leave this on that you can look at. This paper is pretty much written up in the first of those, which I think is online. It came from the conference in Turku. The basic factors is the second paper, and the comparison with America is the last one. But that's enough for now. Thank you very much for your attention.